I got to say that you first came to my attention when I read the essay, The Case for Reparations, which led me to The Beautiful Struggle. And in reading this, there were many thoughts that came to mind. I mean, I've seen other interviews that you've done where you mentioned that the form you took of writing this as a letter to your son. But what else was going through you? What else was propelling you to write this?
Well, to be honest, the letter to my son came relatively late in the process. So I finished writing The Case for Reparations at the end of 2013 and pretty much immediately started writing Between the World and Me. I probably had my first draft by March, and then had a really close to you know what you see here draft by November or something like that. And it was not in a letter form. It was just written as a straight essay. And my editor very much felt like it was still missing something. And so we took the letter form because it helped focus the book. I'm sorry, this is not a literal letter to my son. Almost everything.
But in a sense, it is.
No.
I mean, not directly.
No, I mean that because here's why. Because I mean, no disrespect. Because everything he's heard in there, everything that's in that book, he's heard for years.
Right.
So it's not really new.
No, I don't mean it in the sense that it's new. Just more informative.
Perhaps, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so, it's a letter to my son.
Yes, probably a letter to your son.
Right.
Yeah. The main thing, as I've said many times, is I read James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time as a very, very young man, 19 years old, sitting in Founders Library at Howard University. And like, I remember my head being blown off and not really understanding like what I was reading, but being deeply emotionally affected. And then I came back, you know, basically 20 years later and read it again and understood everything and just, I mean, not everything, but understood like what Baldwin was trying to do, his arguments. And I had like the aesthetic beauty of it was so important. And I think people like miss that about Baldwin. Like, I think, you know, people focus in on his politics and his radicalism, which is all cool. But I mean, you are talking about a gorgeous, gorgeous writer.
Right.
Like just a beautiful, beautiful writer. And I, like for me, when you marry that kind of writing, you know, to the sort of political courage he had, you know, you get really, really great work that, you know, stands the test of time. And, you know, as I've said, plenty of times I call my agent and I call my editor and I ask them, you know, why don't we have books like this today? You know, why does this not really exist as an artistic, you know, form? And the answer was basically, you know, Baldwin was one of a kind, which he was. But, you know, it helps to, like, you know, shoot for the stars. It helps to, like, have that. You're not going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. But you might, you know, get somewhere that you didn't expect yourself to get in the first place.
So how's it for you today having someone like Toni Morrison compare you to James Baldwin?
Well, I think, obviously I appreciate her praise. That's the first thing. I am deeply, deeply honored by her praise. And this is just, I'm just going to, you know, just to clear this up, you know, what Toni Morrison said, because regrettably, you know, from that, you know, people who just did a quick scan over the blurb is he the next Baldwin or not? You know, and that's not actually what she wrote. I mean, what she wrote was personally she felt some sort of intellectual void, and this book helped, you know, fill that void.
Right.
But there's not going to be a next Baldwin, and there shouldn't be a next Baldwin. And I wasn't trying to be, you know, the next Baldwin. I was deeply, 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 tremendously honored, you know, by her praise. But I think, unfortunately, you know, there have been people, and maybe people just do this, period. I mean, maybe this, you know what I mean? Maybe this was just sort of inevitable. But who have read that, you know, in a really, really thin way, you know, and not, I think, gotten the fullness of her point.
Right, right. Well, in the book, you talk a lot about the body,
mm-hmm.
the black body, and how the black body is treated in mm-hmm. this country. You point out egregious acts committed against the black body under the illusion of white America. Some of these atrocities have been physical, some of them have been otherwise. Mm-hmm. Will you discuss those? And before you do, talk about the illusion, the dream, white America.
Well, the dream is what we all, you know, labor under in this country. The notion that what is happening in your cities, what is happening in our cities, the notion that where certain people live, how certain people live, the manner in which they live is somehow natural. That in this country where we have a wealth gap in which for every nickel of wealth that African-American families have, white families have a dollar, that is somehow natural and just the result of hard work. That our wealthy suburbs, even though this is changing a little bit, it was true when I was a child, our wealthy suburbs that ring our cities and our, you know, black inner city neighborhoods, which are characterized by incredible levels of violence and struggle, that is somehow natural. That there is no social policy behind that, that there has not been a policy of plunder in this country, of taking things from black people and giving them to other communities, that everything in this country was fairly gotten. That people who have things in this country got them justly, strictly through their hard work. That all bad things that have happened in this country's history happened a long time ago and are completely irrelevant. Yet all good things that have happened in this country's history, all things that we are proud of, are deeply relevant and should be brought up and invoked all the time, particularly when you're about to go to war with someone.
Right.
That's the dream. That's the dream. So it's okay to invoke democracy and your heritage of democracy when you want to go and invade another country. It is not at any point okay to point out that heritage of democracy is literally rooted in slavery and is rooted in the enslavement of black folks. That's never okay. That's the dream. Mm-hmm. It's a notion of complete innocence and thus immortality, godhead almost. It is a deeply inhumane construct. And if I'm being too, you know, abstract, I can very much, you know, bring it down, you know, on a level. I think, for instance, we had, you know, this situation in South Carolina where, you know, everybody's seen the video, and a young girl was dragged,
right,
you know, out of the seat. And, you know, you would cut on the TV and people say, yes, but what did she do before then?
Right.
You know? And yet you have to believe if black people did not exist in a certain way in this country, if there was not this history of criminalizing black people in our heritage, that, you know, wouldn't even be a question. It's an entire set of underlying assumptions, you know, that structure us, and not just, you know, assumptions, but the notion that those assumptions are somehow just, that they're fair, that they're correct, that it's right to ask that,
mm-hmm.
you know, as opposed to interrogating, you know, why a 300 plus you know, officer, under any circumstances, should flip a child over and drag that kid across the floor.
Or even the question of why are there police in schools?
Or why are there police in the schools in the first place? The acceptance of that is natural.
Right.
And not police in everybody's schools, by the way, but police in certain schools. And the acceptance that that's okay and somehow natural and not at all reflective of anything wrong that we've done.
Well, tell us about some of these other acts against the body that go beyond the physical.
Well, actually, I mean, my case in Between the World and Me is, in fact, that ultimately it all is physical. And that, you know, is really, really, really important to me. You know, I made this case in an abstract way in the case for reparations. And, you know, I really tried to make it in the most visceral way I could in Between the World and Me. The core of this book is the notion that effectively, you know, there is no America as you know it without the physical plunder of black people, okay? The most obvious, don't clap yet. Clap too soon. You know, might go into Holocaust denial or something. You never know what's coming next. I'm joking. I gotta lighten it up because of what I'm about to say, actually. Because you say this, you know, and it does, you know, it takes an emotional toll on you to you know, remark about this night after night. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, we have 250 years of enslavement in this country, at the root of this country's history. Enslavement is not something that was done on the side. It is not a mistake. It is not a bump along the road. It is the road itself. Now, what do I mean by that? 1860, when this country goes to war, the 4 million enslaved black people in this country were worth $3.5 billion. They were the largest financial asset in this country. They were larger than all the productive capacity in terms of worth that this country put together. If you wanted in 1860 to find the largest population per capita of multimillionaires in this country, you would not go to New York, you would not go to Chicago, you would not come out here to San Francisco, you would go to the Mississippi River Valley. And there was a reason why you would go there, obviously. And that reason was that was where the most wealthiest, you know, where the greatest conglomerate of assets was, and that was enslaved black people. And folks who live in the North who like to look at this were not immune from that fact. 60% of our exports was cotton. They came through enslaved hands. There simply is no way to imagine America without that wealth. It's just not possible. Somebody had to be brought over here, enslaved and made to work the land. And outside of that are all sorts of social assumptions that come from that. By the time you get to 1860, you know, Southerners are not, you know, enslaving people with regret. They are claiming, you know, people like John C. Calhoun, who's a great statesman, considered a great statesman of his time from South Carolina, articulated enslavement as, quote, a positive good. It was a good thing to enslave black people. When we have secession in this country, folks argue that, in fact, it is the foundation of a great civilization. There are effects when you think about people like that. And after we had abolition in this country, after we had emancipation, the, you know, 100 years that followed after that, you know, did not commence with a period of letting black people go on their merry way, but it commenced with more physical plunder. And what was behind that all the time was the taking of things from black people over and over and over again. And the thing I tried to get across in Between the World and Me is this is not merely an attack on the black spirit. At every step, it is a physical attack. Slavery is mechanized torture. That's what it is. You know, that's what it means to whip somebody, to torture people into work. That was an accepted form. Black people in this country have been free for 150 years. We were enslaved for 250 years. When you habituate yourself towards certain things, when you repeatedly tell yourself and tell your children, tell your grandchildren, tell your great-grandchildren that the bodies of these people are not worth the same amount of respect as our body, well, that has effects. That has effects. You might find yourself in 2015 seeing a child flipped over in a classroom and asking yourself, yes, but what did she do first? Because you don't have the same basic level of respect for her body, you see? And it's been inscribed in you, you know? And so, you know, Between the World and Me is really an attempt to sketch out the effects of that, you know? There's a line in the book, you know, where you know, I argue that destruction of black bodies in this country is tradition. It is heritage. You know, and when I say that, you know, people, you know, they sort of clutch their pearls and say, how dare you say that? But it's a statement of fact. I mean, what is enslavement? What is lynching? You know, I mean, and so if you do, you know, those sorts of things over, you know, a number period of years, if the majority, the vast majority of your history constitutes those sorts of acts against the African-American body, what is that but heritage? How is democracy heritage and that not heritage?
You write of other abuses against the black body. The bodies of young people face abuses from the schools, which are set up by a system, and the abuses from the streets, which too many times we inflict upon each other. How are these abuses distributed, and does one feed the other?
No, I think they all originate from the same place. Mm-hmm. And I think this is fairly easy to see. I think too often in this country get into a debate. Folks, you know, want to protest, for instance, the violence of the police, the violence of the agents of the state, which deserves special attention, by the way. And it deserves special attention because you pay the police to protect you. And when you pay somebody to protect you and then they harm you, that deserves special attention. It deserves special attention because, you know, unlike, you know, ordinary citizens in America, the police are empowered by the state to distribute lethal violence. That deserves special scrutiny. It deserves more scrutiny. You know, you cannot use the standard of, you know, just run-of-the-mill citizens when people are imbued by the state to kill. You have to use a higher standard for that. But even if we were using the same standard, the point is that the kind of violence you see from police that, you know, we're seeing, you know, on video increasingly in this era, and the kind of violence that, you know, I wrote about, you know, that I feared walking the streets in Baltimore as a child, actually comes from the same source. Behind all of that violence are policy decisions at every level. You know, people, you know, say these phrases like black on black crime or why, you know, you're killing yourselves, you're doing this. Yes, yes, but why? Why are African-American communities more violent than other communities? And what I've tried to illuminate, you know, in you know, my journalism and, you know, to a lesser extent actually in this book, but mostly in my journalism, is that black communities were formed by policy. Mm-hmm. Again, they don't exist, magically. You know, again, just going back to this notion of the dream, you know, we have this notion that, you know, white people walked out to the suburbs, planted stakes, and the suburbs bloomed, and that was it. You know, and that black folks stayed in the inner city and started shooting themselves, and then all these problems came out of nowhere. But within that is no discussion of housing policy. You know, there's no discussion of the fact that, you know, we made decisions in the mid-20th century in this country to create a modern middle class, and we did that through government programs, through government housing programs, that we subsidized loans for Americans, all except one group of people. And that we left those that group of people, black people, pretty much, you know, to the devices of unscrupulous lenders and to make their own way. And this has been totally, totally forgotten and taken out of the conversation. African-American communities look the way they look because they were planned to look that way. It was made that way. That is not a conspiratorial statement. I mean, literally, I say this everywhere I talk. I mean, you can, you know, go to your phone, I guess, if you want to, you know, put in the term redlining and enter Oakland or enter San Francisco or enter LA or enter any other major city in this country, and you will find maps in which, you know, that were drawn by government hands that said what investment would go where. It's not a mistake. And so here we come, you know, in the time I'm coming up in the 1980s in West Baltimore. And these communities, which have been repeatedly plundered, these communities filled with black people who, from the moment they've gotten here, have been plundered. And there's a higher sense of, there's a sense of desperation. And there's a higher degree of violence in those communities. And people say, why? You know, and I just look back and say, why do you think? I mean, what did you expect to happen? What was supposed to be the result of all of that policy? You know, so the notion that somehow the kind of violence committed by the police, you know, who we send into those neighborhoods because we don't want to invest in any other way, the police, the criminal justice system, is our investment in those neighborhoods. Hmm. And the kind of violence that you see, you know, when folks are desperate and folks don't have anything, and you have incredibly lax gun ownership laws, as you do in this country, the idea that one should be surprised by that or look at that as, you know, two different phenomena is just, you know, I think absurd.
You know, for police terrorism against blacks in this country is nothing new. You know, the excuses to justify that terrorism is nothing new. And many of us have, for lack of a better phrase, walked the straight and narrow, gone to school, gone to church, done the right thing, but still wind up victims of that terrorism, if not personally, then somebody they know, you know. How do we protect our bodies? How do we protect the black body against a system that's set up to terrorize?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't have an answer for that. And that really is the space that this book came out of. It came out of that frustration. How do you? How do you? You are a minority in a country that is a democracy. White supremacy in this country is largely a democratic movement. It is not true that there is, you know, merely this, you know, cabal of people, you know, a small minority of white people who is somehow pulling, or people who believe themselves to be white, as I say in the book, you know, who are pulling the strings. Donald Trump is a democratic phenomenon. I mean, you have to say that. You know, he is in Iowa and someone is going to those rallies. You know, and it's not just, you know, five businessmen who are going to those rallies.
Right.
Lynching in this country was a mass phenomenon. The laws that gave us mass incarceration, you know, in this country, people voted to put those politicians in place. You know, prosecutors don't, you know, run to the right and say, you know, I'm going to put, you know, I'm going to be tough on crime, you know, to appease a cabal. There's a population of people that wants this, and there's always been a population of people that wants this. And so how do you assemble a critical mass in a democracy of people who say, who hail from the majority, who hail from the, you know, the group of people with power, who say, no, no, we don't want this? And I think what it requires is some sort of interest that goes beyond your immediate interests. You know, something that goes beyond a kind of a paranoid fear of crime. You know, something that goes beyond, you know, the notion of, you know, all of the protections and privileges that come from being white, and extends to the interests of your children, and extends to the interests of your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. One of the really depressing things that comes out of American history is that every opportunity when we face this issue, the majority population in this country has effectively punted. And so at the end of the American Revolution, you know, folks know that enslavement is a problem in this country. They know that, you know, it could potentially, you know, divide the country. And instead, you know, we got the Three-Fifths Amendment and all of these sort of, you know, compromises, and we punted. And so in 1860, 600, 700,000, 800,000, the numbers keep going up as, you know, they assess, people in this country were killed as a result. And then at the end of the Civil War, you know, folks attempted Reconstruction for a minute, and then they punted again. Hmm. And then you got 100 years of terrorism. And one might argue that even during the Civil Rights Movement, we punted again. You know, because what we effectively did, and this is my argument in the case for reparations, is we outlawed, you know, certain types of plunder. We outlawed certain things, but we made no effort to make any sort of redress for what had become, for what had come before that.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are. Here we are. How do you get, you know, the people with power in this country, people with varying levels of power, but certainly people with more power than black folks in this country, to declare some sort of interest that goes beyond their immediate? That to me is the question, and I don't know. I don't know how you do that.
You know, we're taught when we're young and become of age that, you know, you need to vote, be a part of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Your vote will make a change.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of people who have, you know, gone to the polls, gotten to the booth, and cast their vote for whoever or whatever policy, they haven't seen that change, or they may have thought they were voting for a change and become, again, a victim of, you know, the policy. What do you think of the process, the political process, the democratic process here? And, you know, do you think there's a real way to make that benefit everybody?
Well, I think you do have to vote. I mean, I do. I actually, you know, I think if you're going to make a decision to be in this country, you have to participate in the political process. I didn't always feel that way, but I certainly feel that way now, and I think it's really, really important. I just don't think it's enough.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, you know, don't vote. I just don't think, like, it's vote, and then, you know, you go sit on your butt, and that's the end. I especially think it's important to vote in local elections. I'm just going to go on my vote rant for a minute. Because it's a real thing. I mean, people always ask, well, what tangible can you tell us, Ta-Nehisi? Like, statewide elections are very, very important, especially, you know, as we come up on 2020, because there's going to be redistricting, and that's going to determine what your House districts look like. And so, like, the insanity that you see in Congress and the House, people wonder why it's so crazy. Well, it's because they rolled up all the state legislators, you know, and then they, you know, basically drew the lines in such a way as to have, you know, the kind of craziness that we have right now. I just don't think that's enough. You know, I think we have a much more profound philosophical question. As I said earlier, you know, the problem is a basic, you know, problem of democracy. You know, in theory, like, man, I hate saying this. Democracy works under the idea that, you know, a mass of people in general, if you take the temperature of the mass of people, they will do the right thing. And yet we have a lot of evidence that, you know, groups of people often in majorities don't actually do the right thing. You know, they don't. And so again, I think like the next level, and that's not a, you know, argument against democracy, but I think the next level is how do you get a critical mass, mm-hmm. you know, in a majority to actually do the moral thing?
Do you think enough people know what the right thing is?
Well, I think the deeper question is, do enough people want to know what the right thing is? You know, I don't think knowing the right thing is actually that hard. But, you know, I don't think it's particularly difficult. You know,
right?
I mean, I think, you know, if an alien, I always say, if an alien came to America and observed that African Americans were at the bottom of basically or near the bottom, you know, depending on Native Americans or whoever, you know, at the bottom of every socioeconomic category, you know, in this country, and then observed that, you know, for 250 years this group of people was enslaved. And then for another, you know, 100 years, they were basically, you know, subject to a long, you know, drawn-out terrorist campaign, sometimes endorsed by the state, sometimes featuring senators, you know, standing up on the Senate floor and endorsing that terrorism, that they were subject to plunder through the removal of of tax dollars out of their community without having any sort of say in how those tax dollars are spent, that they were cut out of some of the great wealth-building opportunities in this country that we talked about in terms of housing, that at the end of that, they were subject more than any other community to a policy of incarceration, of mass incarceration, such to the point that, you know, African-American males in this country who were born in this generation have a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison. African-American males in this generation who drop out of school have a 60% chance of eventually going to prison. If an alien was to observe that and try to match it up with the stats, it would be no question about what had happened, not be confused at all. Nor would it be much question about what we needed to do if we were trying to design a just society. Mm-hmm. But do people want to know that? See, that's the question. Because once you know that, you know, Baldwin says, you know, to know, you know, then you got to go act.
Right, you got to do something.
You got to go do something about it. But if you don't, if you can always plead ignorance, if you can always retreat back into the dream, back into your own nobility, well, then you can be clean. Everybody want to be clean, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. You know, with when I read the case for reparations, which I think was stated and laid out fine, I've talked to people who may not have necessarily read the essay, mm-hmm. but just heard the word reparations. Mm-hmm. It seems like that word brings fear or nervousness in this country. Somebody feels like if there's reparations for this group of people, then my group of people is going to be losing out on something.
Well, I mean, yeah, they will lose out. I mean, reparations probably will cost money.
Right.
You know? So you probably will have to pay something. That's true. But we pay people all the time. We lose out all the time. You know? I mean, part of the condition of being black in this country is to lose out. So welcome to the club. But I mean, even put that aside. You know, most of the time the problem is you are holding me responsible for something that I did not individually do. I didn't own any slaves. Let's, you know, take it even further. I didn't design the housing policy in this country. Why should I have to pay? And my answer to that is you should have to pay because the basic theory of American government is that you pay for things that you did not, that you are not personally responsible for. If you think about that, without that concept, government basically falls apart. So, for instance, there are, I'm assuming, you know, highways out here in California that, you know, need upkeep. Mm-hmm. Some of my tax dollars might go to that. I can't say I'm never going to drive down those highways, so why should I have to pay?
Right.
I did not personally authorize the Iraq War. My tax dollars went to support it. There's just nothing, I don't have any say over that. I was not alive, for instance, during World War I, or World War II for that matter. And yet my tax dollars go to pay for pensions, you know, for veterans and the families of veterans, you know, for both of those wars. Why? I'm not personally responsible for that. So the question is not, you know, whether you're gonna, you know, pay for things that you did. I mean, if every taxpayer only has to, you know, get an itemized bill, the government falls apart, right? It's an argument for anarchy. There's always some amount of redistribution of wealth. I mean, that is part of the basic theory of government. The only question is this particular argument for redistribution just? That's really the only question. I mean, you know, I didn't do it is a ridiculous argument.
Right.
It can't be respected at all.
Well, one of the statements that comes up with that is, you know, you people need to do for self. You need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps.
Well, you do need to do for self. I mean, you
but
do.
But there's more to it.
Right. I mean, that's, you know, everybody should do for self.
Right.
I'm a fan of doing for self. I think it's a good thing. But that doesn't really answer the question. You know, I mean, we have government in this country. It exists. I mean, are you going to argue for the, you know, complete abolition of government? You know, should we now go to people who are over 65 and say, you know, you need to do for self. We're not going to pay your Social Security. You know, are we going to do that? You know, are we, you know, going to, you know, suspend the myriad, you know, of programs that we have in this country? Are we going to go to our homeowners and say to them, we will no longer give you a tax break, which is, you know, a subsidy, effectively. It really is. We will no longer give you a tax break because you need to do for self. Are we going to do that? Are we going to go to big businesses? You know, I don't know if it's here. Where's the Chargers? Are they moving to L.A.? I think they are. You know, are we going to say to these football teams that move and get their, you know, their stadiums completely subsidized, you need to do for self? No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to do that. Everybody should do for self. I'm a fan of that. But we have government in this country.
Right.
You know, and so the only question is, what is a just and fair, you know, theory for how that government, you know, should be utilized? And you know, I think in terms of reparations, you know, it is a demonstrable fact of American history that black people in this country have been repeatedly, as a community, injured and plundered, and that they should be repaid for that. You know, it's fairly simple as far as I'm concerned.
But what does that look like to you? What does that look like to you?
You said what?
What does that look like to you? The reparations.
I have no idea. and I'm fine with having no idea. I mean, I have all sorts of spitball theories, like everybody got all sorts of spitball theories. I mean, it definitely looks like money. I'm pretty convinced that. You know, but you know, how, I mean, you know, I don't know if it's like, you know, for a generation or two, you know, folks don't have to pay for college. I don't know if it's, you know, literally a jobs program. You know, I know that there's certain people, for instance, in the case for reparations who I chronicle, who are very much alive, who were directly discriminated against, who should get a check, period. I mean, that just seems to me, you know, pretty easy. But here's the thing. It's not like we ain't done reparations before. It's not like we don't have any practice at this. We do. We do. You know, very justly and very correctly, you know, we're in the Bay Area, and there was a Japanese-American community, you know, that was unjustly interred in this country, and very aggressively and very rightfully and righteously argued that they would do reparations. And we did it. We did it, as we should. You know, we had a commission that studied it, you know, under the auspices of Congress, that studied the problem. You know, and then made a decision that these folks deserve reparations. It's not like we don't have practice with this. We've done it before. The only question is it just? You know, it's not, you know, well, I don't want to be in the business of reparations. It's not because you are in the business of reparations, by the way. You are. Mm-hmm. It's not a question of, well, I only want to be responsible for what I personally know. No, you're going to be responsible for things you didn't personally do. That's the basic theory of government. You know, the problem is convincing people to see what is right, you know, in front of their eyes. Because it's right there. It's not even, you know, it was hard to write that piece, but then it was not very hard at all. The evidence was just so overwhelming. I mean, it was not even difficult to deal with.
You know, one of the things that impressed me about Between the World and Me is that you put a lot into a small space. I mean, the book itself is, what, 100, 152 pages?
152 pages.
But you cover a lot of life in there.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the process of writing this?
Yeah. This will be fun. I wrote it 4 times. I mean, it's not that long, but still, writing it 4 times is, we'll have effects. And, you know, I'm happy people, you know, I'm happy that the book is, you know, popular. I'm happy that it's selling. I'm happy that people are reading it. But it's very hard for me to see it from this side, you know, because, you know, I remember, you know, being at my little cafe that I go to or being, you know, in my office at home and being, you know, completely frustrated, you know, and the book really, really not working and the book not doing what I wanted it to do. When I started writing, I did not have a really compelling theory for why the book should exist, you know, except some vague notion of beauty and art. And I mean, the signature trope in the book, for instance, this notion of the body, I mean, came after I wrote like, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 words. And then when I went back and read it, there was like one paragraph that was about the body.
Hmm.
And I was like, oh, that's something. I should rewrite and just focus on that. I should go write it again and just use that little bit. That's how it goes sometimes. You know, it's just not, it's not an efficient process. And when I look at Between the World and Me, you know, what I see and what I remember is all of the fear that went into that book. Like how afraid I was that it wasn't going to work, that it wasn't going to be a book, that it was going to fail. Every time, you know, I write, I think, this is the moment when they figure out I'm a complete fraud. This is it. It's going to happen now. I've been waiting for it to happen. It's clearly time. And I think everybody sort of feels that way. I think there are a number of people who had a talent to write. But can you repeatedly face that fear over and over and over again? That really is the difference. You know, it's not the talent, I don't think.
So how did writing start for you?
Well, like I said, I had this vague notion of Baldwin, and then I went and sat down.
Well, I mean this book, but just overall.
That's what I mean. No, it was just like, okay, so what now? And what did I know when I sat down? I knew that my friend Prince Jones, who's a central part of this book, I knew that I wanted him to be a part of it. And so the first coherent part of the book that came together was his death and going to talk to his mother and interviewing his mother. So that was a real physical thing. The rest of the book, it was really, it was just flailing. It was almost like journaling. It was like, how do you feel right now? And I think at some point, I had like this chronological line that began when I left my parents' home and went to Howard. And it's funny because like I was looking back, like I literally in the Word document, I literally have four different drafts. And I was looking back at the first draft. And the thing that was in the first draft that I saw today was, I was like, I think it started, when I was 17 years old, I left, my parents' home and went to Howard University. And then I'm trying to explain like why that was such a big deal, like why that meant so much. And what I immediately stumbled upon was it was a big deal because college means a certain thing for African-American families. And what it means is a kind of escape, an escape from fear, a fear that dogs black folks in this country. And though I didn't know it then, like I had kind of like just tripped over the one of the fundamental tropes of the book. Mm-hmm. That's how it happens with things like this. It doesn't really happen like that with the journalism. I think, there's a much stronger idea with journalism of what I'm trying to do and what should happen. But so very often, like I just, for something like this, you just kind of trip over it.
You just mentioned Prince Jones. You wrote of something that we're often told when we're children, go to school, get good grades. That's a road that's going to lead you out of the neighborhood. That's a road that's going to keep you away from the police. And Prince Jones did that. Mm-hmm. He went to school, went to college. Mm-hmm. He even became religion. Religion was a big part of his life, as you mentioned in the book. But he still became a target. There's no way to avoid that.
Well, there's no way to avoid the danger, certainly not. That is the weight of policy in this country. I keep saying that over and over again. It's very, very important. Listen, if you pass certain laws repeatedly, if you, I'm just going to say this to him blue in the face. It's like if I as a human being spend the vast majority of my life, I'm 40 years old, if I, and I've been an adult for, let's say, 22 years, if I spend 17 out of those 22 years doing something negative with my time, that has an effect on the rest of my life. It weighs me down. You know what I mean? It will be very, very difficult to go and do other things. It'd be very, very difficult to stop doing that negative thing. It's no different with a country. A country is an entity. And if that entity spends long periods of time telling itself the black people are preternaturally criminal, the black people are not human, the black people are not to be trusted, the black people are not to be considered citizens in the same way as other people, the natural result is that people like Prince Jones die. The natural result is that girl being flipped out of her chair and dragged across. It's just what's going to happen. And it will happen again, by the way. This will continue to happen. And there's nothing that really can be done in the short term, this year, next year, that will stop it. You will be seeing videos like that probably for the next 15 years. And the only thing that'll stop it is people will just get tired of showing it on TV. But the videos are the result of policy. They come from heritage. They don't come from something that was just done yesterday. If you spend your time telling yourself that this group of people, you know, is effectively, you know, an enemy amidst, you know, in your midst, if you have a situation where, you know, you have a president of the United States who has to stand before his country and pull out his birth certificate, because half, and in some instances the majority of the opposition party, of one of two major parties in this country, does not believe he's a citizen. That's not a mistake. That's the weight of history. It's what has to happen. It's just the grim, ugly math. And there really, you know, just is no way around it. So, I mean, we can't tell, you know, who's going to get killed or, you know, or where or how. But those deaths are just going to happen. I mean, that just is, that's the reality of it. Don't be so stunned.
Not stunned. Just still disappointed that it continues to happen. You mentioned going to Howard. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in college, at that young age, we're still learning. But we form certain ideas, especially when it comes to identity. What were some of your personal discoveries in college?
Well, I discovered how broad and nuanced I discovered how broad and nuanced the Black diaspora was in the world. It was. I had never. At Howard, there were Black people with, relatively. There were Black people with money. Black people who had like the kids came to school and they had a car. That was something I had never seen before. I didn't know what Jack and Jill was before I came to Howard. You know, and it wasn't I came from the projects or something. I did, you know what I mean? It wasn't I had grown up, you know, in complete poverty. But there was certainly a level of wealth that I had never, that I didn't know, you know, Black people had. There were places in the world where I didn't know Black people lived. I didn't know there were Black people in Montreal. That had never occurred to me. And then there they were at Howard University. Right. You know, there were, and I hadn't, really had very little experience with this. There were Black people there who, you know, for almost their entire life, and Prince was like this, they had, you know, been the only Black person in their class, or, you know, had grown up in, you know, really, really majority white environments. And those Black folks were the most interesting to me because they ran the Howard. I mean, it was get me out of this. I don't want to ever, you know, they would be the most racist Black people, right? The ones that had grown up around white people would be the most militant, the most, you know, going right to the Nation of Islam, you know.
Right.
It was hilarious to see, you know. It's really, I was what'd they do to you? They all right, you know. and while I'm joking, it's because they, you know, I had whatever trauma I had in my life, you know, I didn't know what it was to be the only. I didn't know what it was to have, you know, to be in a classroom and have, you know, a teacher say, okay, it's your job to speak for an entire community. You know, to explain these Negroes to us. I mean, I didn't know anything about that, you know? And so, it was just an incredible diversity of human experience within, you know, under this, you know, rubric of Blackness, under this ethnic group, and this global ethnic group, you know, of Black folks. That was incredible to me. I mean, it was just such and the women were so beautiful. The women were so, so beautiful. Do you know what I mean? And as a young man, and I'm gonna make a...
I mean, I've seen pictures, sis.
And I'm not just saying that, right? I'm saying that because what it became was and they were so beautiful in so many different ways. And that's really, really important when you live in a society that tells you you are not beautiful.
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying? It wasn't just you know, I gotta get that. It was good God, we're gorgeous. We really, really are gorgeous. And, but it was beauty on every level. I mean, it was, you know, I made the mistake of starting a book tour there. And we had, you know, our first event. It was a huge, huge mistake because it was beautiful. Just as beautiful as I remembered it on every level. I mean, the students were so sharp and intelligent, and they had had that, you know, black experience just so baked into them. You know, it was just so far ahead. And it was incredible. I mean, it was just an incredible experience, you know? Yeah. You know, if you got, any college seniors in here, and they are not, you know, applying to Howard University, you have made a huge mistake. It might not be too late to remedy that mistake, but you should at least apply, man. Because it's never going to happen again. That's the other thing. Like, it's the only, and I think people don't get this. For young black folks, it's like the only point in your life where you will be, you know, sort of just ensconced in blackness and have that opportunity to ask all of those, like, questions that you wanted, you know, to answer that can only really be asked when, you know, you are, you know, around your own. And you're young and you're developing and you're figuring it out. And then after that, you have to go out into the world and go to battle, you know? And so I think it is an experience, and I would go so far as to say an educational experience that defies, like, SAT score, that defies college ranking, that just can't be matched. I mean, you just can't get that anywhere else, you know?
You write of the Mecca at Howard. What did the Mecca mean for you?
It meant that, you know, as I said, you saw black folks from everywhere. You know, it was a beacon, you know, in the black world, and it drew, I just didn't realize we were so different and then at the same time the same. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't understand that, you know. I've never been anywhere else where I, you know, in one, like, single place where I got to see, you know, so much diversity. Again, under, you know, the umbrella of black people. It was incredible.
And Howard is where you met your wife, right?
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations.
That happened too.
You also write of reading a lot of books when you were in college. Reading a lot of books about black history. But you mentioned in reading these books, and this is a quote from the book, I did not find a coherent tradition marching lockstep, but instead factions, and factions within factions. So what kind of effect did these discoveries have on you, some of your previous thoughts?
You know, in terms of my writing and as a writer, and in terms of my intellectual development, that it's always a fight. You know, it's always a fight, that it's not, you know, a bunch of black folks saying, okay, we are going to all walk in this direction, that folks are fighting, you know. And even people who you admire, you know, are fighting. I mean, sometimes viciously, you know. Just, there's a piece up on the New Yorker today, and a guy went and broke into James Baldwin's home in France. I don't know why anybody would do that, but... despite the premise, it's actually a beautiful piece, and part of it reflects, like, the kind of criticism that Baldwin got, which, good God, ran again. I didn't realize how much it was. I mean, it went from Martin Luther King to Ralph Ellison, you know, to the more well-known criticism of Eldridge Cleaver, and that is the life, you know? I mean, that is the writing life. I mean, it's a fight all the way through. Though I think some of that stuff, you know, can be, you know, vicious and can be personal, I think ultimately, like, that's correct. Like, it should be an argument, you know. That is how you clarify yourself. That's how you get clear about, you know, how you feel and what you think. So I think that was important. Mm-hmm.
There's another statement in the book that's really stuck with me, and it's, again, in the form of, you know, the letter to your son. So I feared not just the violence of this world, but the rules designed to protect you from it. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of parents could relate to that fear. But can you speak further on that?
Yeah, I mean, the basic idea is, you know, the notion that if you, you know, somehow make yourself more respectable than other people, you know, you can somehow immunize yourself from the violence or protect yourself, you know, from the violence. And I think those rules in and of themselves are dehumanizing. I mean, the one I take issue with, and I'm so sorry to do this, because I love my people, but the one I take issue with all the time is, like, telling your kid to be twice as good, which I think, like, causes you to closet yourself, you know? It makes other people the standard for your humanity and for your respectability, for your self-respect. And they should not be your standard. You know, not because they're, you know, particularly evil or anything like that, but precisely because of the opposite, because they are invested in no more, you know, nobility or no more quality or anything else than you are. You know, you are your standard. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's good enough, by the way. That's good enough.
Right.
You know, I think implicit in that notion is that, you know, the white world is the sun, and you know, you revolve around it, and you make your rules based on it. And I got that. You know, I got that. You know, I understand the intelligence of that. I mean, part of that, it's just a basic philosophical difference. You know, my dad, you know, was an entrepreneur. He picked the most amazing business model that one can pick. I don't even know if it was a business model. Did. and what he did was, his notion was that there was an entire tradition, an entire literature of black folks, authored by black folks, about black folks, that was basically being allowed to disappear, that was going out of print. And, you know, my father dedicated his life, you know, has dedicated his life to making sure that that didn't happen, to republishing, to making sure that, you know, this sacred work was available to folks. One can't arrive at that goal by using white people as a standard. That's not a twice as good ambition. That's like here. You see what I'm saying? Like that, right. That is here. That's not, well, I'm gonna, you know, do what they doing and then try to, you know what I mean? That is a self-motivated standard. It comes from a deep examination of oneself and what is important, you know, in one's own eyes. Not, you know, well, I see this guy doing this over here, so I'm gonna try to do X, Y, and Z. And so, you know, I have, you know, and this is not possible to do, but it's always been my aim. I have tried to live in, you know, complete disrespect and disregard, you know, for other folks who stand in terms of that, you know, to you know, to figure out what I wanted and what I was trying to do, you know, and then do my best, you know.
Your dad was a publisher, and you mentioned early in the book that. I think there was a time when you had to write about,
yeah, it was my mom.
Something that you had done in school.
It was my mom. Yeah, my mom used to make me write all the time.
How did those two things, you know, your mom making you write and your dad being a publisher, did that help shape you as a writer?
Sure. I mean, I think it's why I'm here. You know, I don't think it was just baked in. You know, I was just completely baked in. I had books all around me. I had to write. My mom was a teacher. Reading and writing was very, very important in my household. We didn't have much else besides books. I mean, that was just what you did. That was really what you did. And so I think when it came time for me to, you know, decide what I was going to do, and, you know, I didn't have much else. This was what I had, you know, been exposed to. This was what I knew. So, yeah, I don't think it's, you know, it's very hard for me to imagine myself without that. Hmm.
Before getting to college, what were some of the things that you were reading when you were younger?
A lot of comic books. ton of comic books. Yeah, that was probably the biggest. I read a lot of comic books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I saw an article where you talked about that, reading comic books.
Mm-hmm.
And the comics that you read the most were, I guess, from Marvel,
mm-hmm.
because of the type of world that they would portray.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that for a moment? And for folks who may think of comic books as just, you know, child's play, talk about the importance.
Comic books are awesome. They're great. I mean, they are America's mythology. You know, they really, really are. And I think, you know, I haven't thought too hard about this, but I think, like, if you, as a young man, you know, living in West Baltimore, the way Baltimore was, and, I've talked to other, you know, young African-Americans who came up at the same time, you are looking for some sort of sense of power and escape. And Marvel at that particular time, for whatever reason, and I don't know why, you know, I don't know if this has something to do with the Jewish experience, because so many of their writers were you know, hailed from that experience, but a large part of the heroism was like you didn't get rewarded for that. You know, like people would throw things at Spider-Man, and, you know, J. Jonah Jameson would write these nasty headlines, and, you know, he would save a bunch of people, and then he'd get booed for it. Right. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, and the X-Men would go out and they would do X, Y, and Z, and they would try to save humanity, and people would, you know, basically try to wipe them off of the face of the earth. And that just looked familiar. All that looked familiar. You know, so you know, you kind of identify with it, you know. Those were like my two favorite titles as a child. And it was great. It was great. And you know, and it would just like, you know, expanded my vocabulary, you know, because of the words they would use and the things that they were, all this like really scientific vocabulary that you wouldn't encounter anywhere else. Because, you know, science fiction is a huge part of it. Also, you know, I think like as a form, like I feel, if I can just go off topic for a little bit, I feel like great despair for people who encounter superheroes through movies and not through comic books, because they're missing out big time. Because the way, you know, comic books work, and it's very similar to how books work, is, you know, you see these pictures with these words, and you have to make an imaginative leap from panel to panel. Like, you have to imagine what happens in between. And thus, for every individual who reads a comic book, it is an individual experience. It's not, you know, all laid out for you. And so, like, these sort of fantastic things can happen in your brain that can't really, like, happen with CGI. And when you're a child, like, that has great effect on, like, your imagination and your imaginative capacity. You know, it as an aesthetic, it's all through my writing, you know?
Right. Well, the brain's the original world of special effects.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
I have some questions from our audience. Have you read The Devil Finds Work by James Baldwin and Playing in the Dark by Toni Morrison, talking about ethnicity in media? And if so, do you agree with them?
No, I've read neither. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm not even going to fake like I have. Sorry. It's too many books. I mean, it's just too many. Listen, probably my favorite writer is E.L. Doctorow. I have not read all of Doctorow's books. I mean, it's just, books for me, like, are the evidence of one's mortality. Because, you know, you get to a certain age and you say, wow, I'm just never going to know that. There's just not, there's not enough time. And some of those books are great, tremendous books that probably would help you a lot. It's just no time.
Right.
It's just not enough time. I'm here talking to you. I should be reading somewhere. You know what I mean? I can feel it. I'm dying over here.
In The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin writes of white people, "You must accept them and accept them with love." We've read and heard a lot about how Baldwin influenced you. Where do you think love, acceptance, compassion figure into what you've written and the future of race relations in the U.S.?
Well, I did read that. I did read The Fire Next Time. I am probably a lot more concerned with self-love and self-acceptance. And that is not to say what Baldwin is talking about wasn't important, but, you know, I'm probably much more concerned with black people accepting themselves and loving themselves. That's like really important to me.
So if May 15th is clear on your calendar, will you be the commencement speaker for the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism?
That's a question. No. No. May 15th is not clear on my calendar. That's the first thing. I will be, you know, studying, you know, trying to improve my awful French. Hopefully by May it'll be a lot better. So no, I'm sorry.
What is this?
Thank you, though. I'm very flattered by the invitation. I don't want to sound rude. Thank you.
What is the significance of your arms? It's an odd question, but you mention them often in Between the World and Me. So the significance of them is wondered about in your work and life.
My arms. Is that what the question is?
That's what the question is. I mean, I read about the body. I don't remember.
I don't know.
Specific,
I don't know. I mean, I guess I was running out of body parts, and I don't know. That's not a bad question, but like again, I think it goes to like the distance between like somebody who's doing a critique could probably better answer that question than the person that's actually creating the work, because you're necessarily you're in a bubble as a creator. You can't see it from the outside, and there are things that often you do as a writer that you're not even seeing. because all you're doing is going from word to word to word sentence. It's like you're trying to, you know, make the thing work together, but it's very hard for me to read that book. In fact, it's impossible for me to read that book and have the same experience that you guys will have. I just can't. That actually is the importance of criticism. So somebody else probably is better able to answer that question than I am.
Okay. 1 year ago, and this is from the audience, 1 year ago I was serving a life sentence in prison. Upon returning home, I've observed an even greater divide and demoralization of African-American culture. Many books speak of our plight and our problem, but how do we map out an effective solution in spite of all of our opposition?
I don't know. I just don't know. Better people than me have tried that. Smarter people, wiser people than me have tried that, and here we are. I appreciate the question. I don't want to be disrespectful here at all. I'm a writer. I'm not a leader. I'm not an activist. I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a politician. The position of writer, I've said this before because sometimes how this has gotten flipped. The writer is really a student, okay? The writer is absorbing things and learning things and then, trying to, make it into some sort of creative format and putting it, out to you. But the writer is not an expert. The writer, as far as I'm concerned, is not even really a professor. It is the act of public learning. I don't even like the term, public intellectual. I think that conveys too much. There is so much. Read the question again. I want to be really clear about this. The last part of it. Read that last part.
How do we map out an effective solution in spite of all of our opposition?
Right. So, the we is a big thing. The we is a huge, huge thing. The Black community is a huge, community, of some, 40 million people of all sorts of, varying backgrounds and lives. The opposition part of that is a huge, huge thing. I find myself, in my journalism, trying to take that apart piece by piece. So you want to talk about housing laws, right? It takes me a year by myself to study that, and to produce something like the case for reparations. And even when I finish writing it, I know that I haven't fully mastered it. That it was like five books that I didn't get to that I should have got to. And those five books probably would have led me to other books. I just published a piece on mass incarceration.
Right.
And the best thing I can tell you is I know what I don't know. That's what came out of that. There is so much that I don't know. There are all these extra questions that I didn't get to in order to write the piece. And so, it is highly unlikely that any one person, can articulate an answer to that question. And I guess I'm kind of skeptical of any one person who would. I would be deeply skeptical of that because the problem is so huge and so massive. I don't know. I kind of recoil at being positioned as any sort of expert or anything like that. I write.
Right. You write in your book, the police departments of our country have been endowed with the authority to destroy your body. Obama's recent speech in Chicago to the International Association of Chiefs of Police, saying police officers get scapegoated for broader failures in society and the criminal justice system. Do you agree with him? And how would you respond to his assertion that police officers get scapegoated?
I think police officers do get scapegoated. I think that's exactly correct. I think he's right. This is pretty easy to see, and you should be deeply skeptical of any sort of notion that says it's going to address the kind of things that you see on camera. It's just seeing on camera every day by reforming the police. Because what it does is it lets people off the hook who have passed policies that put the police there in the first place. And to go back to, where we started here, this notion of police in schools.
Right.
There's a great article on Vox today that shows how there is a direct correlation between the number of students of color in any school and the presence of police. The police are not in every school. And it's more than this. It's like they charged those kids in South Carolina criminally with disrupting school. That's a criminal charge.
Right.
Disrupting school. That's a policy. That's something somebody else, decided. And so, when you begin with the officer doing the thing, you let yourself off the hook as a democracy. Why was the officer there in the first place? Who made that a crime in the first place? Was that really the only solution? Somebody made a series of decisions that it was going to be that way. You know, I talk about this with Freddie Gray all the time because, you know, like you have to break down like how that arrest happened. If you begin with Freddie Gray, you know, screaming and being carried into the paddy wagon, you've gone for the okie doke. You missed it. You missed everything that happened before that. Because what happened was Freddie Gray is standing there. He sees an officer. Him and the officer make eye contact. The officer decides that Freddie Gray looks suspicious. Freddie Gray runs, and this is an arrestable offense. It's an arrestable offense because we've decided that, you know, you can be arrested for certain things in areas that are designated high drug crime areas. It is not an arrestable offense on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. That's a policy decision. Mm-hmm. It doesn't begin with the officer. So, I completely, maybe for different reasons, but no, I think he's exactly right. We've made a decision that we are going to invest in black communities through the criminal justice system and in no other way. That's a decision. And so, you know, I mean, that don't mean that the officer, you know, shouldn't have got fired the day as he would. That don't mean that at all. But if that's your standard, if that's the enemy, you're just going to keep coming back again and again and again. And you end up talking about individual officers, which, I mean, in its own way, it's actually a really conservative formulation of the question. Because it says if I can get more individual, moral, correct acting officers in place, then maybe we can fix this, as opposed to looking at entire systems,
right,
which is actually the much more radical position. So no, I mean, you know, I've had my disagreements, you know, certainly with the president, but I think he's dead on. I think he's correct.
This is from one of our young, our 10-year-old audience member.
Does it say I'm 10 on there?
It does. with a drawing.
Can I see?
Has your son benefited from this book?
Is that supposed to be Samari?
That may be a self-portrait, though.
Yeah, maybe it is. I don't know. I hope so. You know, I hope so. We'll see. We'll see. I don't know. I hope he hasn't been hurt by it. That's what I, you know, more hope so. I hope he hasn't been hurt by it.
I can't make that one out. Mm. What do you think of the Black Lives Matter movement? Would you say this is the new version of the freedom struggle?
No, I think the Black Lives Matter movement is the Black Lives Matter movement, and I think it's good. You know, I think it's good. I think it's correct that, you know, when you see the kind of things that we've been seeing over the past, you know, 4 or 5 years, that, you know, folks protest and make their voices heard. So I think it's good.
This is one from one of your Howard alumni. As a graduate of the Mecca, do you see a time in your career when you will teach at Howard, a class or a summer workshop series?
Well, first of all, I'm not a graduate at a Mecca, so that's the first thing that would have to be remedied. I'm not a graduate of anywhere. Oh, and I see the big HU on the
right.
I mean, one would hope so. Yes, eventually one would hope so. Yes, I would love to.
Have you read The Code Book by Neely Fuller Jr.?
No. No. If you ask me about any book, it's like a 95% chance I have not read it. I mean, frankly, you know, most people in this audience probably read more than me because, like, when you write, you have to focus in a particular area and then you have to write.
Right.
You know, and, you know, so you don't get to read as much and then you have to come, you know, and talk about your writing at places like this and you're not reading.
When you could be reading, right?
Yeah. No, because it's funny because that was what I didn't, and anybody who has an ambition in this audience of, you know, any young people have an ambition of being a writer, just remember, if you really, really enjoy reading, you're actually going to read a lot less. That's a necessary corollary of it, and I didn't realize that.
What do you want your legacy to be?
I just want to be a good human being, a good father, a good husband. That'll be okay.
What can white people do to promote, help make reparations a reality? What are some small and big things that can be done?
You said what?
What are some of the small and big things that they can do?
Between the World and Me was written in rejection of the question, what can white people do? It is not the job of black people. It should not in any moral sense be the job of black writers or black people at large to improve white people. And that, that's not because, again, there's something particularly wrong with white people or anything like that. But when you ask, you know, me to tell you what you can do, you're putting the burden on me for something that really is also your problem. It's as much your problem as it is my problem. It's an American problem. Finding out what to do and what you individually, as a human being, which is much more important than you as a white person, you know, can specifically do is actually not that hard. You know, you take an interest in something, you know, you read about it, you educate yourself, and then you try to match your passion to some sort of, you know, effort that makes this country a better place. I don't think it's particularly complicated at all, and I think, like, that burden, which, you know, has been put upon black people to somehow be the moral center, to somehow explain the laws of this country, the laws of this universe that we live in, I just think it's wrong. You know, I think, you know, I didn't write this book to explain to white people. I wrote this book to express something about being black in this country, primarily, though not exclusively, to other black people. Right. And so I just, I don't want to be in that position. You know, I don't want to be someone who makes his money by telling white people how to be better. You know, I don't want any part of that. And you shouldn't want me to do that, by the way. Like, you shouldn't want that at all. You know, you really shouldn't.
So this is a multi-part question. What do reparations look like? What does reconciliation look like? What are the physical, spiritual, material aspects of reparations?
So let's go to the next one, because we went through that. Right. We actually went through this one, so let's go to the next one.
What is your opinion of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow?
I think New Jim Crow is a very, very important book. I think, you know, my own writing on mass incarceration is indebted to it. I think we wouldn't be having, you know, sort of conversation that we're having about mass incarceration without Michelle Alexander's book. I think, like any other book, like my book, like any book, you know, that folks, you know, are reading, where you're being introduced to something, I think it's very, very important for you to read beyond that. But I think you could, you know, not do much worse than to have, you know, that be your introduction. You just have to keep going. It's very, very important that you keep going. And that's true of any book. You just can't stop there. You can't, don't read Michelle Alexander and then, you know, decide you're an expert. Don't read any book and then decide you're an expert. That should be your introduction and you should keep going.
This is just a comment. This person, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you for the brilliance and exquisite writing, particularly the first 42 pages describing fear and our culture of fear.
That is not a question, but thank you.
One way to look at your book is that it has two audiences. In one, you're speaking to black people to help them contextualize their experience in America and their identities in relation to this country. In another, you're speaking to white people to help them understand the world they have created in this country. Were there any points in writing Between the World and Me where you were cognizant of tension between speaking to both audiences?
No, never, never. And I think that's death. I think for writing, it's that you have to speak from here. You know, my goal, you know, whenever I'm writing anything is to, you know, I'm aware, obviously, that the majority of the audience is going to be white. I'm very much aware of that. But my goal is to not temper anything, you know, to speak in my books as, you know, I would speak if it was, you know, just me and five other black people. That's how I try to write, you know, because that is what is within me. I think, and, you know, just it kind of goes to, you know, my rejection of that earlier question. I think that there are, there's a way in which folks accept a kind of burden, black writers, you know, black people in public positions, of bringing white people along, you know, of, as far as I'm concerned, condescending to white people, of softening, you know, very unfortunate realities that may hurt people's feelings sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't think as a writer, you know, I would be particularly respectful if I did that. You know, if I go, you know, hear some sort of, you know, some feminist author, you know, explain, you know, some sort of theory about gender or whatever, I don't want anybody softening things for me because I'm a man. You know, if, you know, somebody's writing a history on, you know, gay rights in this country or the LGBT community, I don't want people softening things because I'm straight. You know, I want people, you know, give it to me. You know, punch me in the gut. Give me all you got. You know, speak to me as you know, with your truth. And then let me decide how I feel about that.
Right.
You know, don't soften things for me. You know, don't, you know, try to, you know, hold my hand through it. That is completely alien to, you know, my own studies and my acquisition of knowledge. So no, you gotta speak from the heart. You really do. There's no point in writing. We don't get paid enough. You know, if you have to be a sensitivity counselor, there's no point in writing that.
Can you discuss how your discourse on the dream responds to and critiques the dream discourse of Martin Luther King?
You know, I don't think it does, actually.
I don't think so.
I mean, I know that, like, it looks that way, but I, you know, I picked that because of the irony in it. You know, like, as a literary device, I thought it was, like, really, really cool. Like, people normally associate dreams with, like, great things and beautiful things. But that was more a literary choice. It wasn't a critique of you know, the I Have a Dream speech.
Right.
I mean, people can see it that way. Again, that's like me being inside, right? And then somebody on the outside might read it, you know, and they might, you know, see that. But as a writer, that wasn't my intent at all.
If there is no America without suppression and dehumanizing of black people, two questions arise. Do you believe this country can ever stop this suppression and dehumanizing? And how does America look different without the suppression and dehumanizing of black people?
Well, the answer to the first question is we don't know. Most countries, most states in the world, you know, have at their root the suppression of some other group of people. The second question, you know, what does America look like without it? It looks like an America that fulfilled its own ambitions, that truly became exceptional. And, you know, we go around the, you know, country telling people, you know, how we're more exceptional and this and that, and this is, you know, okay, make that real. You know, do the thing.
Right.
So.
How are you dealing with celebrity?
Not well. Not well. I am, you know, I'm 40 years old, and so, like, when something like this happens and you're 40, it's you're already a formed person. You know, you are who you are. And, you know, in my case, I like who I am. I enjoy who I am. I don't know, fame and celebrity has never been a particular ambition of mine. You know, I'm joking about being here right now, but, like, there's a part of me, you know, it's, like, really, you know, incredibly private. And, you know, even as I write memoir and that sort of thing, you know, it's not, you know, that I have any sort of shame about writing about my life, but the writing is the writing. And then, like, there's me.
Right.
And the writing's done. You know, I think I'm done posing for pictures forever. and you know what, not out of any disrespect for anybody, or not even out of being, you know, tired, you know, of posing for pictures, but, you know, it just feels like the work is what you should pose with. You know what I mean? Because the work is the thing. And I, you know, I, you know, as Ta-Nehisi, am I like a person with, you know, all these sort of flaws and all of these, you know, sort of problems and issues and, you know, whatever. You know, the work is what matters. You know, the work is what I'm proud of. I'm happy that people are reading the work.
Right.
You know, that you know, fills me with great joy. I'm happy that people are inspired by the work. You know, I don't mind when, you know, people say, listen, I really like that. You know, I really love that. But I think, unfortunately, when you are smart in one particular instance, people think you're smart in all other instances. And you're not. You're just not. I mean, you really, really aren't, you know? And so I think the other thing was because of the way they moved the book up. You know, like, it was supposed to come out in October, and then, you know, they moved it up to July, and the book was written relatively quickly and published relatively quickly. I mean, we were still making changes, you know, as late as, like, May.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you see The Galley and you read the book, there are actually big differences between the two. Like, there wasn't much adjustment. Like, it just kind of, you know, suddenly happened. I think because I've been writing for 20 years now, and, you know, for most of that time, it's, you know, been, you know, relatively, you know, anonymous. It is shocking. Like, it really, really is. I'm processing it now. I think I'm gonna get a therapist, you know, to figure out how to, you know, how to maintain myself. Self-care, as they say.
What's the origin of your first name?
My first name is an ancient Egyptian name, and it is the ancient Egyptian designation for the ancient kingdom of Nubia, translated in various ways as land of the blacks or land of black people. It was given to me by my dad. I did not choose that. I would not have chosen that. I'm very proud now, but I would not have chosen that.
Can you comment on the idea of cutting your nose to spite your face, specifically on how some white Americans will destroy the safety net simply to stop black Americans from receiving the same benefits?
Well, I mean, one would have to ask, is it cutting your nose to spite your face? I mean, that presumes that white supremacy ultimately, or white supremacy, at least in the near term, does not, you know, benefit folks who define themselves in that way. I'm not clear about that. You know, being white in this country, declaring yourself white in this country, is an interest. I mean, it is a real, real thing. You know, I'm reading this book. A book I'm actually reading. And no one's gonna ask me, have you read such and such? It'd be nice, but no one ever asked me. So I'm reading this book called Citizens by this guy Simon Schama, and it's a history of the French Revolution, and he is talking about how on the eve of the French Revolution, there was a whole group of aristocrats in France who were actually poorer than the peasants. But being an aristocrat was really, really important to them. And there was no one who more guarded the privileges of being an aristocrat than a relatively poor aristocrat. And they did because it was an interest. It was an identity. It meant something to them. I mean, you can see this in, like, slaveholding, right? People think, like, slaveholding was, you know, like, a shameful thing in this time. It was not. It was an aspiration. It was as aspirational as being a homeowner today. To own, you know, another human being, to possess another human being, was a statement of great power. It, you know, enrolled you in a particular class of people. And even if you did not own slaves, if you lived in a place like, say, you know, Virginia, for instance, you were, you know, if you were, you know, a white male of military age, you were mandated to be a part of the slave patrols. You had to, you know, serve on that service. And what that meant was folks were enrolled in a kind of class where every day of their life they got to feel superior to a group of people. I mean, the slaveholders say this. You know, John Calhoun says, you know, talking about slave society, he says the difference between our society and your society is that the white rich and poor are equal. And our, you know, underclass is, you know, black people. Now, you can quibble with that, and you can say, well, you know, you can't show that in dollars. But I think that denigrates the very real feeling of being superior to somebody. You know, being, you know, able to go up and to, you know, we don't like to say this, but being able to, like, just abuse somebody, to slap somebody upside the head, having somebody have to step off the sidewalk when they see you, rape somebody. I mean, this can be a part of your identity. This can be in and of itself an interest. Knowing that your child will never be Trayvon Martin, that's an interest. That's a real thing. Knowing that in general, I keep going back to this, no, you know, officer is going to come into the class and flip your kid over and drag them across. But that's a real thing. So I think, you know, it's worth asking, you know, yourself, are you? I mean, is it really your nose? You understand what I'm saying? Like, are you really actually spiting yourself? That assumes that, you know, like that we share the same aims for society. Maybe we don't. Maybe we don't. And I think it's, like, worth confronting that. You know, like, white supremacy is not a side thing. It's a real, real thing. It is not, like, a subject, you know, that is in the way of having this grand conversation about class. It's an actual thing in America. It means something.
Given government's central role in the repeated plunder of black bodies, why do you believe that government can, why do you believe that government can, much less will, play a positive role in addressing these harms?
That's a great question. That is a great, great question. Believe is probably a little too strong. I don't have any other answer. I don't know that there's another option. You know, the other option is, you know, as far as I'm concerned, armed rebellion. That's not an option. I know people are going to clap for that. Go ahead. You can clap for that. That's fine. You know, I mean, we can have an argument about how that ends up. But I'm not, you know, in that camp. I'm just not, you know. I think, you know, we're part of the country, you know, and if you're part of the country, you have to work towards a political solution, even for those of us who have some doubts about whether that'll actually happen, you know. That's part of the tragedy and absurdity of being human. You know, I'm not, you know, prepared to, you know, pick up a gun. I'm not that guy. I don't want to be that guy either. I just don't. It's not who I am. You know, seen enough violence. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for me to imagine another way.
And you may have just answered this next question, but if not the government, who or what institutions of governance might be the central actor of restitution?
There is, there's obviously business. I mean, there's that, and that's part of it. That's definitely part of it, because they, you know, business as an entity has been part of plunder too. But the government is actually really, really important. You know, the government is the manifestation, a democratic manifestation of folks' will in this country. And so I don't know how you get away from a conversation around policy. I just don't. I mean, the way the African-American community looks, you know, in terms of its socioeconomics is deeply tied to government action. It's very, very important to say that, because government action is what is done in our name.
Can I read your book to my fifth grade students? Many of my students live in a neighborhood which is the product of redlining and racist social policy.
Well, that's a decision you'll have to make. All right. You're the educator, not me.
You mentioned that we're a democracy, and that there's a mass of people who vote for our current policies of inequitable outcomes. However, there is something to be said about the powerful elite, the few who hold most of the wealth and the power and privilege to create and implement policy. What is the relationship between these two oppressive bodies?
Can you repeat that again?
Okay. You mentioned that we are, okay, I'll read the question. You mentioned that we are a democracy, and that there's a mass of people who vote for our current policies and inequitable outcomes. However, there is something to be said about the powerful elite, the few who hold most of the wealth and the power and privilege to create and implement policy. What is the relationship between these two oppressive bodies? The masses who perpetuate white supremacy via voting and daily actions, and the powerful elite.
I don't know that I understand the question, to be honest. I mean, there are all sorts of relationships, right? I focus on the democratic problem because I think even without the powerful elite, the quote-unquote powerful elite, we would still be faced with a problem. That, to me, if it really were, you know, just, I don't know, the Forbes 500 or the Fortune 500, whatever they call it. Like, we'd be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I really, really believe that. But again, you know, I go back to this, you know, over and over again. There are people who believe and they have to be taken seriously. There are people who show up at that Donald Trump rally and have to be taken seriously. And those are not, you know, merely, you know, executives in suits. I don't think, you know, poor and working class, you know, white people in this country are duped by, you know, by racism. I think it's an actual interest. I think it's a real thing. Is that a note saying that's our last question? Not at all. It's another question.
Actually, this will be our last question.
Oh, beautiful.
With all of the cell phone videos coming out documenting abject police brutality against black people, do you see a tide turning towards a more just law enforcement system? Or is the outrage only reverberating inside the social media echo chamber?
No, not at all. Because until, as I said earlier, until you address the actual policy that puts police officers in the position to act in certain ways, nothing will change. You can't take a hammer to every problem and then ask yourself, why is the hammer acting like a hammer? You just, you know what I mean? You can't bring a hammer to every job. You just can't do it. and they say, why is this not a screwdriver? It just doesn't work, you know? And our decision, you know, in terms of African-American communities, for many years as a policy has been to use hammers. You're in school. You know, I'm sorry, I keep going back to this, but like, you know, girls disrupting class, okay, why not just take the L? Why not just take the L, file a report, and keep going? Why the hammer? You know, because that's what happens in other schools all the time. I mean, you know, we don't have police officers like that everywhere. But the answer, anytime you have a problem with black people, is the hammer. You know? And so, you can't, you know, to torture the metaphor, you can't reform the hammer. You know what right. I mean? Like, you need new tools. And so I don't think, you know, the video is sufficient.